We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about the new media world and some of the conditions faced by new media, how they are and perhaps are not like media that has come before. Online media platforms, things like YouTube and Facebook, increasingly are taking on the role that for a very long time now has been played by big broadcast networks and big publishers. And these new media, in a very public sort of way, have embraced values like openness and comprehensiveness. And what they want to do is to give to patrons the chance to explore without limits, or at least to tell them that they have the opportunity to explore without limits. Now, at the same time, online media sites also have to make choices about excluding content, and they do, because they're concerned about things that might get them into trouble with the law or conflict with community standards. So this morning we'll be talking a little bit about how new media try to do this, try to be completely open and at the same time have limits. And our guest for the program is Tarleton Gillespie from the Department of Communication at Cornell University. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk on this very subject. The title of his talk is The Politics of Platforms, and he'll be speaking this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on the campus on South Gregory. And these programs are always free and open to the public. This is an event in the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2009-2010. They're calling Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. And we have had several of the folks in this series on the program here. We like to take the opportunity to talk with people who come to the campus and maybe that way bring them and their ideas to a larger kind of audience. Everyone cannot go to the talk. Of course, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana and you want to go, feel free. It's wide open. But we're glad to have Tarleton Gillespie here on the program, and we can talk about some of his ideas. The number, if you'd like to be a part of the conversation, is 333-9455. That's just for Champaign-Urbana. We have a toll-free line. Good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. You may also send us emails to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thanks very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
We appreciate it. Now, I know a little bit about you and your work, and I know that, for example, one of the things that you have written about is digital copyright issues. In fact, you've got an entire book on that subject. But this is something now I know you're getting more interested in and doing writing about and thinking about, and particularly this issue of how it is that these kinds of online information providers, and we could be talking about Google, or we could talk about YouTube, Flickr, things like that. You know, how they manage content, and in a way, try to do it in a way that really doesn't look like they are. So, how is it that you got interested in this?
Well, so the discussion about copyright, which you know, if you care about technology issues at all, you know, it sort of flared up over the last decade or so. I was looking at the copyright issue not in terms of, you know, how should the law change specifically to deal with X or Y, or which business model was going to win. I was looking at it in terms of, here is a debate that on the surface looks like, can kids pirate? Will iTunes succeed? Does the law handle this kind of violation well? But underneath it was a discussion about how is culture shaped? How do, you know, who owns things? Who decides what counts as an owned product? Who decides who distributes? And while, you know, that's not to say the copyright isn't the right mechanism for managing that, those questions about how that gets applied to a new environment, those questions run deep. They run deeper than who's downloading the latest pop song. So I found it a great opportunity, a case study, to think about how as we shifted to new technologies, but also new businesses, new ideas and ideals about how we encounter the things that we listen to, the things we care about, that we were having a discussion about authorship, ownership, distribution, but we weren't always having it in the deepest degree. So the next step, once I sort of finished the book that dealt with how the copyright questions were playing out, and particularly the role that technology could could play in enforcement and what sort of benefits and also risks were involved. I started to say, well, what was the point of that concern? I love thinking about copyright, but that was sort of a case to think about a bigger issue. And for me, the bigger issue is we encounter and take part in a sort of broad culture, whether you're thinking about entertainment, whether you're thinking about news, information, and it happens on a playing field that is in some ways defined by the providers and the technologies that we encounter. Those providers and technologies are changing. And as we adopt new models, as we try on new formats, as we start to grab onto the latest media platform, we need to ask questions about how their approach, how their business model, how their technological arrangement, how their the norms they begin to establish are setting the terms for the sort of broad public conversation that we need to have.
Yeah. Well, you and I know I've seen some of the stuff that you've written and the way that you've talked about this, and you said something that I think in one talk that I saw you give, this was the one at the Berkman, where you were talking at Berkman at Harvard, something I thought was really interesting, and that has to do with how particularly everybody, but young people particularly, come to new media. Mm-hmm. And the idea is sort of something like, well, people seem to accept the idea that if you pick up a newspaper or a magazine, or you're watching television, you know that they have decided, they have sort of decided on the menu that, and it's not everything, you know, you open the newspaper, you know it's not everything. Mm-hmm. It's what the editors of the paper have decided to put in there for a variety of reasons, business reasons, other kinds of reasons. Right. So they've made a selection and they say, here you go. Something like Google, for example, there the idea is that this is your gateway to everything. And that but one of the things that you found in talking with students is that they sort of accepted and were onto the one notion that, yes, somebody's doing some editing. But with online platforms, things like Google and other things, they seem to have bought heavily into the idea that it's the access is there for everything.
That's right. That's right. So we have a long tradition of asking about the role of gatekeeper, and the you mentioned whether it's the editor of the major newspaper or the person who sets the prime time schedule. We know that they're making a selection from a very broad range of potential topics, potential perspectives, a very narrow set of choices, and that is both a good and a bad thing. And we've figured out how to ask questions about how that can go awry, how that can change the sort of available discussion about political issues, about cultural issues. And that's exactly right. So my experience with students was they knew how to sort of recite that argument. I don't know if they bought it, but they knew how to recite it. And when you ask them about Google, that it seems like there's two faiths that they were accepting. One was that Google offers us everything, that Google is simply a lens or a mechanism to get to the web. Which is fundamentally not true. It doesn't serve everything. And there's all sorts of legal and business reasons why Google has to sort of bound what they offer, even more so when we start talking about media platforms like YouTube or Facebook. Mm. And a second thing, which is that the way they do it is algorithmic. They don't do it by human choice. They do it by a technology. So there's a complex search algorithm. You put in the terms, and it provides back what it thinks is the most relevant. And so a faith in the technology and a faith in the business of trying to offer everything seem to take away the critical question of, are there choices being made? Those choices are different than a newspaper would make or a TV network would make. Nevertheless, there are choices. And that's part of what I think we're just beginning to ask questions about.
Yeah. Well, I think that's interesting because it seems to me that we wouldn't be having the kind of discussions we have about net neutrality and the importance of openness and access and all those sorts of things if people weren't concerned about the kinds of choices that these providers are making for us. Why is it that people seem to say, well, I understand that the newspaper does that, but that they're not thinking about the fact that Google is doing it?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, part of it was a real pleasant surprise to see the interest in net neutrality as broad as it was. That could have been one of those topics just like FCC broadcast licensing, where a very particular group of people who know to care about it cared about it, and the rest of us could sort of overlook it. I think part of it is that, you know, the experience of searching on the web through Google, the experience of going onto Facebook and looking up names, going onto YouTube and looking up videos, for the most part, we don't run into silences. We don't run into a failure to offer us something. In fact, we're sort of confronted with abundance, right? We go on Google and it says, here's the first 10 of 120,000 searches on this very specific, you know, specific topic. So we're not encountering that moment on a regular basis of saying, well, the thing I want to know isn't here. So the question then of sort of what is not only missing, but also what gets privileged and what gets sort of left on the outside, I think is a harder question to ask. The topic has been raised and raised very well about net neutrality, which is, you know, can the underlying technical infrastructure choose between providers? But I think we also have to develop an attention to, you know, we go to YouTube and it feels like the archive of all video. And in fact, YouTube's a business and it has legal obligations and it has a kind of care being taken about what's appropriate. And when a provider decides what's appropriate, I don't question that they should ask that question. But then we have to ask how they ask that question.
Yeah. And that's not something that it seems not something that they're really all that interested in talking about, not in a really open way. Again, because what they really want people to they want to promote the idea that it's free and wide open.
That's right. That's right. In my research, I found them quite open to talking to me about it because the people who do it find it a really fascinating and difficult challenge to figure out these sort of gray area cases. It's not hard to say, you know, that's hardcore pornography that doesn't belong on our site. But there's lots of topics that exist in a sort of middle realm about what's slightly over the line. But you're right. In their sort of public statements to users, they want to say, you know, this is a free and open space, anything you want. We have a commitment to free speech. What they don't talk about very much is both the boundaries and also the complexity of they're trying to make a double business. They want to host user content. They also want to host professional content. And they want to pair advertising with both of them, ideally. And that makes choices not just what gets left off or removed or censored, but also what looks like a flat archive. Go in and search and you get whatever, right? And, you know, if my video is up against a Disney video, if mine comes up higher than a list than Disney's, then ta-da, mine's more relevant. But the massaging of that search is not a neutral process.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Tarleton Gillespie from the Department of Communication at Cornell University. And here's visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk, The Politics of Platforms. That's this afternoon at 4. This is part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2009-2010, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I want to talk about the term platforms.
Sure.
Now that we're in the world of new media, platform, this is one of the big buzzwords. Mm-hmm. Everybody's talking about different platforms to distribute content, and they want to have everything across all the different platforms, and because they really have to. Your old media organizations like ours, we're thinking about all of our different platforms. Everybody's mm-hmm. doing that. And until relatively recently in this context, I had never heard this term platform. Mm-hmm. Now I know what it is. When did we start talking about platforms?
Yeah, so I find the language game of it really fascinating, and not just because, you know, I like language, but when this stuff ends up in political discussions inside of court cases, it's all about the language. So there are a lot of people who really don't like the fact that YouTube can call itself a platform, because for the computer business, platform meant something you can build tools on. So that meant the PC platform or a server platform or a computer language platform. But that term has sort of migrated into here's a platform for content, here's a platform for speech. And I think it's very telling that the sites that are hosting our media content have adopted this term. I think that it not only links them to the computational version, right? This is a sort of building platform. This is of sort of social value. But it also brings in all those connotations, right? The political platform and the platform that supports people. And when you look at the way that some of these providers talk to users and talk to their advertisers and talk to their media partners, the term does a lot of work across all those categories. So for users, it's broadcast yourself. Here's a place from which to be heard, just like a political platform, opportunity. And think about the metaphor. It's flat, it's open, it's not picking and choosing, but it's helping everyone sort of stand tall and be heard. When they talk to advertisers and marketers, it's a platform of opportunity, right? We'll get your brand in front of people. It's much more of a traditional media offer. And those in some ways are contradictory, right? The one platform for users is you can all be here. It's a big platform. And for media partners, it's we can get you to rise above the rabble so that you're seen and you're heard. And that's our provision. In the legal environment, it's great. Sometimes they're asking for regulations that help them, and they're saying, we are a platform for free speech. Look at what we do to help people. Other times they say, we're merely a platform. It's users that are putting infringing copyrighted material on our site. It's not us. We just sort of host them. So that metaphor does a lot of work. It's indicative, I think, even when the term's not being used, it's indicative of the kind of position that they'd like to see themselves in.
Yeah. And I think the part that's really interesting, well, it's all interesting, but one part that I think is particularly interesting is the connotation that they like that they are simply a place to stand. It's the old version of the old speaker's corner. You know, here, you just go over there, stand there, and you can say whatever you want.
Right.
And that their argument would be that, hey, we're not regulating content here. We're not responsible. It's just the platform. It's just the place where people stand. And this is the kind of sort of battle that old media have waged as well. And I think the kind of the parallel that you suggest is the telephone company, which would make the argument that, well, if somebody uses the phone to plan a crime, well, we're not part of the conspiracy. You know, we just provided the conduit. Mm-hmm. They used it. So don't hold us responsible if somebody does something bad and having talked about it over the telephone.
Right.
And in the same way that these folks, these more modern platforms, are trying to say the same thing. They say, you know, even though they are involved in shaping what's there, they're wanting to say, and particularly I guess they're wanting to say to government, say, hey, we're just the pipe. You know, we're not responsible for what people put down the drain.
That's right.
You know?
That's right. It's very parallel. I mean, these structural metaphors matter a great deal. It's very parallel to the idea of conduit, which ended up being a very important term in the regulation of the telecommunications industry. As so long as you are simply passing information through your telephone lines, you're not picking and choosing. You can't be held to the same liability that a publisher can, who is picking and choosing. Now we see channel for television, we see network, and we see platform. We've yet to see platform play into that sort of regulatory environment where that metaphor gets assigned to them, but in the workings of trying to claim that position, I think it's been a very important term. But it's even wider than that. So it's part of the offer to users. It's part of the sort of self-presentation of these sites. I think it does a lot. What's telling, I think, is the other metaphor you hear a lot, which you often hear when these sites are explaining why they do need regulations, why certain things are inappropriate, which is community. Right. Mm-hmm. So sometimes YouTube's a platform, sometimes it's a community. And in some ways that depends on what it needs to say at that moment. So if it's saying we need to be a little stricter about profanity or, you know, sexually suggestive content, it's for the sake of the community. The community offers up a different thing. They're kind of the patron of the community. They're assuring the safety and health of that community.
Yeah.
And that offers a different kind of rhetorical position.
Well, and that's, again, what's interesting and which shows you that something like Google, for example, is in a complicated position because there are a number of interests that they're courting. They want the support of government. They need the support of advertisers. They want to get as many eyeballs as they can, but they also have a community that's much more they're not just sort of casual users. They're much more passionate about it and how it runs and what's on there. So they have to try to keep all of these various groups happy.
Right. That's right. And both the community that's super intensely involved and has theories about how Google should run and the wider community that thinks they just want access to the web. I mean, you think about a site like Facebook having moved from a relatively specific audience, a couple universities, college kids, very specific age, to a much wider set of universities, to alumni of these universities to adults in companies to high school kids to now anyone with an email who's 13 or over. So think about the kind of transitions that Facebook has sort of catered to a very particular kind of thing when they were only a campus environment. And as their business model pushed them to get more and more people, right? That's a limited market. As you wanted a bigger, bigger piece of the pie and they saw the opportunity to do that, you now then are catering both to the college kids who want it to be a space that allows their kind of talk and their kind of imagery, and this thing where the mom and her concern for her 13-year-old kid can somehow be catered to as well. So these, you can see shifts in these platforms and how they sort of manage themselves in light of the managing these multiple communities.
And we have a caller here to bring into the conversation as we get close to our midpoint. Someone up in apparently they changed their mind. Well, in any case, folks who are listening, you can call, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Let's talk some more about how it is that some of these platforms do this content management in a way that is maybe not real obvious and where stuff that's maybe problematic or near the line is still there for the people who want it and know how to get to it. But essentially what they've done is that they've buried it. They haven't gotten rid of it completely, but they've kind of buried it.
Right, right. So one of the things you see when you look across these platforms about how they approach the problem of dealing with content that they've decided is beyond the pale, sort of inappropriate, is the question of whether they should be proactive or reactive. So some of the sites, and it's almost always a balance of the two, some of the sites will begin to look for content that they think is inappropriate as soon as it's uploaded. Other sites will say, we only wait until users have flagged content, and that puts it in a queue for us to look at. And those are very different positions in terms of how you're responding to things, not just to say that reactive is better, right, because proactive is sort of more interventionist, because reactive is a very interesting position for them to claim. It's an avoidance of responsibility, too, saying it's not us, it's the users who are checking these things. Flickr has a really interesting situation where you wouldn't know it from most visits to Flickr, but Flickr has hardcore pornography on it. And if you didn't know how to look for it, you would never see it. So they ask their users to grade their content as safe, moderate, or restricted. They go through and they correct things that they think have been misrated. And when you go to Flickr and search images, you're in a safe search mode, so you can't find things that are restricted. If you go and reset that setting, then you can see anything you want. And so it, you know, the analogy I have is sort of like the porn's in the back of the video store. It's there, right? It can be part of the business, but somehow if you want to see that video store as just catering to mainstream tastes and family audiences, you can somehow like ignore that it's there. Except they've rendered it invisible, right? For the video store, you always kind of knew it was there. You couldn't go in there, but you kind of knew it. You know, they were aware that that was part of their business. In Flickr, you could experience Flickr for years and never even realize that that's on there. So that's one technique for trying to have sort of both audiences. A place like Facebook is taking a much stricter rule that says, you know, we have a guideline that says no nudity, no sexual content, and we proactively take things down and we respond to flagging from users. And they promise a 24-hour turnaround, which is incredible. Flickr is now the largest archive of photography online. Facebook is bigger than all the other sites. They have something like on the order of 50 people who are dedicated to this job, just checking content that's been flagged, looking at new images that have been put up. So that's a very different approach to sort of managing content for these boundaries.
Well, that gets at the point that I'm sure that as time goes by, and that actually happens very quickly, as the amount of content the sites handle grows, the problem of trying to manage the content and just looking at everything gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Sure. I mean, that's YouTube's response. So, YouTube says we simply can't look at things proactively. And so we only take this reactive. We wait until things are flagged. And then they go into a queue, and it depends on what you flag it for. There's a whole bunch of categories. So if you flag something as child pornography, it's going to go much faster to be viewed than, you know, this is incidental drug use. But everything goes into the queue, and they respond to these things. And that's both, yes, a practical solution to the immense amount of content they're dealing with. But again, it's also a strategic one, right? Because, you know, they're facing a lawsuit from Viacom that they aren't being diligent enough about taking infringing copyright material off their site. If they could prove that they were quick about taking pornography off, then they'd be in a tougher position for the courts that they're saying they can't take infringing copyright material off. So there's a balance between a practical limitation, a commitment to free speech, which I think is genuine, that they want to err on the side of leaving things on, but at the same time, a strategic need to be both tending to their community and positioning themselves legally as not being able to tend in a certain kind of way.
Yeah. It sounds as if the kind of issues that they're concerned about, or the kind of material that they're concerned about, mm-hmm. comes in a fairly narrow category. That is, that they're concerned they don't want to get sued. They don't want to get into legal trouble. So you can see where there you'd be concerned about content like mm-hmm. pornography. Mm-hmm. But you wonder, well, if they're doing that, then are they exercising other kinds of editorial judgments right. about other kind of content, and right. and where, you know, where do you, how do you stop moving from that to say either exercising judgment about political speech mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose from there then you do get into other issues about, which gets back to the net neutrality issue about, well, for commercial reasons, are you going to favor some speech over others?
That's right. And this is where it comes back to a more traditional question. These are the questions we had to ask about newspapers and radio and television, that of course there's selection, but can the selection that might be for legitimate reasons turn into selection that might be for questionable reasons? Mm-hmm. I find really interesting, you know, that there is some risk about sort of political speech, although part of the way these sites sort of trump or champion their own value is to say, you know, we're the place where, you know, the Iranian protest videos are showing up. The news people can't get it fast enough right here. So we're playing this role. I think it's more a place about sort of cultural mores. So, you know, you have a rule against nudity and you know, sort of blatant sexual content. Fine. Both Facebook and LiveJournal before it have run into problems because they censored images of women breastfeeding. Now, wherever your politics are about that, that is a contentious issue about whether that is akin to nudity because you might, you know, catch a glimpse of a nipple, or if it's a very important sort of visible activity. And so, you know, here's a site where, again, whatever your politics are on that particular issue, they're having to make a decision about whether you allow those images or whether you close those images down, and drawing some real fuzzy lines about what counts as too much exposure and what doesn't. I mean, just like the ratings board for the movies, I mean, when you really draw these lines, it's a lot of drawing in the sand. But a place where, you know, if those sites were to establish a norm on one side or the other of that issue, that's very powerful, especially for, you know, the huge amount of users who are coming into that space and thinking of it as a glimpse at all things that people care about. That's where that kind of intervention, I think, gets tricky and happens in a relatively invisible way. That's a curious example because the people who are concerned about the removals began to create Facebook protest pages saying this was an inappropriate sort of intervention on their part. And Facebook backpedaled a little bit and drew a sort of fuzzier line in the sand about how much you can see before an image becomes unacceptable.
Yeah. We are a little bit past our midpoint mm-hmm. here in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Tarleton Gillespie from the Department of Communication at Cornell University. He's visiting here in Champaign-Urbana, visiting the campus to give a talk as part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2009-2010, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. We've had a number of the speakers in the series on the program. We're glad to have him here. And if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you can hear him talk about the politics of platforms this afternoon at 4 in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory in Urbana. They are open to the public, so anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. 333-9455, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. So how different really are new media, at least in the respect that we're talking about here, how truly different are new media from
old.
Well, I mean, you know, we're watching the business models play out. I mean, there's clearly going to have to be some adjustments about how things get paid for and how things get distributed. I do think there's something to be said about the fundamentally different role that user-generated content is playing. So, you know, it's not as if there wasn't editorial pages and community radio and community access television, but the fact that YouTube is heavily sort of amateur, you know, non-professional content produced. Wikipedia is, you know, produced by a whole range of people. Flickr photos are an archive of a massive collection of people. Both the fact of that participation, I think, is really interesting. The business model has to be different. The role that a provider can take about being a gatekeeper or not being a gatekeeper has to be different. And the perception of users is different, right? So what you expect to find and how you can trust the things that you find and, you know, where value comes from in the culture. I think those are the places where both the businesses that are doing this and the kind of wider political culture is grappling with.
You know, given the differences here and the fact that while maybe one of the differences between new and old is that with new, it's not like the gatekeeper function's not there, because it clearly is, but it's different, and it may indeed be a little bit looser, more open, at least in the sense that you say. You know, for your local newspaper, you can't go down to the newspaper and give them a story and say, here, print this in the paper.
There it is.
And there it is.
Right.
But you can you can do that with the web. So that is a little bit different. And yet, given that somebody is making some decisions, like I'm going back to the idea of how it is that some people come to new media and they're not thinking about that. They're really, I think that they're maybe making a greater distinction along those lines of, you know, access and gatekeeping between the two than there really is. And I wonder, you know, why it is and that why people are maybe being a little naive when it comes to new media.
Right. I think that's true. I think that we have to be a little smarter about the role that they're playing. I don't want to overstate that because it is a different role, but there's kind of a belief, you know, A, that these sites grew up just sort of hosting and serving this content. B, that they simply open the doors, right? They just create a site that's empty and then people just post whatever they want to post. And C, that a lot of these companies developed before they had a business model, right? So before they figured out how they were going to attach advertising, how they were going to partner with commercial providers, how they were going to, you know, target advertising to particular users, their business model was, let's get as much stuff as possible, right? Let's win the race to becoming the site where you should put pictures or the site where you should put video. And that in some ways made them err on the side of including more stuff. Now they're running into this problem where it's not so much growth as maintenance, right? So they have to be YouTube, not just become YouTube. And that becomes a very tricky problem for them. So now they have to balance what their users want to make and then what fits sort of advertiser expectations or public perception. And that gets a little trickier.
Do you, and this may be a little bit off of your interest, but
that's all right.
Are they making money? It seemed like for a long time these things were very hot and they were very big and they were going very fast, but nobody was making any money
because
they weren't exactly sure how. Are they now making money?
Yeah, you know, it's very hard to get a good, clear answer on that, right, because it depends on how you measure things. YouTube as an example, my understanding is that YouTube itself still doesn't make money, but as an element of the Google universe, that's not so much of an issue. It's a component that they're still working on. My sense is that a number of the platforms have reached a point where they are self-sustaining, so they aren't in that place where it's like, well, we're sure we're going to find a business model soon. But it's very hard to get good, clear answers on that because that's, you know, that's information that they don't necessarily want to provide for their competitors.
And for old media who have decided that they have to have new media platforms, it seems that sometimes you have to wonder that they don't really quite understand what they're doing, what the difference is between the new and old, and that they're doing the new because they feel like they have to, but that it's something that's been tacked on as an afterthought to what they had been doing all along.
Yeah.
And whether that really – does it really do anything for
them? Well, I mean, I think we've definitely gone from a gold rush where people tried to jump on the internet because they thought it was profitable to a panic rush where they think if they don't, they're going to die. And it's not clear whether they're wrong or not in that assessment. But, yeah, the game is different in the digital environment. It's not just different because this was the first observation. People can copy and duplicate and pirate, and that's a very hard thing to track down and stop. That was an important question, but it overwhelmed all the other things, which was you've got different expectations of people participating. You've got different you're standing next to your competitors in a very, very easy way for people to jump between the two sites. So if your site sort of loses its cachet, loses its feel, then it's you know, why wouldn't you just sort of go to the next thing? People can aggregate your content with the content of your competitors, and they don't experience you anymore. They experience you as just a line item in all of their radio broadcasts or podcasts or news reports. And so I think that, you know, the kind of value making that people are going to figure out. I mean, this is, you know, this is the, if what we're talking about is sort of the risks of market behavior, that you're going to be conservative, you're going to draw boundaries. The benefit of market behavior is someone's going to keep pushing until they can find a way for this to work where it satisfies, you know, the users and there's some sort of business model. But it's not clear what that is yet. And so I think people are coming to it from very different models. You've got people who came up through information technology and are building the kind of things that Google builds. And then you've got people who came up through a traditional media environment. And I think the underlying assumptions are very different. And it's very hard for an organization to kind of turn that corner. And that's part of why we're seeing some of the things you were pointing to, the kind of clumsy tack-on afterthought versions. It's getting better. I think the new environment for that is mobile technology. So I think people are now starting fresh with the idea of, you know, delivering content in the app form. And seeing how that will play. I wonder if that's going to be some kind of leveler where people are going to have to create for that environment in a way that can't just be sort of reproduced.
Well, and so are we really getting to a point where and maybe this has always been true, that the devices are shaping the content. The thing we're using to access the content is really having a lot to do with what the content looks like.
I think so. I mean, this is part of the technoscience question that the center is trying to ask is, you know, to what role do the technologies play in this? And, you know, I'm cribbing from Jonathan Zittrain here, where the story about the mobile technology is very interesting. If the internet was this kind of intended to be this open platform, mobile platforms aren't quite like that, right? Apple gets to decide which apps go on its iPhone. Google gets to decide which apps go on the Android. It's a much more locked down environment, and we've accepted that, even though it's sort of the new internet, and the internet was this thing where anybody who wants to post a site can post a site, and you don't want, you know, you want net neutrality, you don't want the infrastructure to pick and choose. We're shifting over to these handhelds where the infrastructure does pick and choose, and that puts Apple and Google and Nokia and, you know, these companies in a very powerful position. And I think the booksellers know it, and they're watching, you know, how Apple handles the iPad and how Amazon handles the Kindle. The telecommunications companies know it. The media producers know it. So all the battles we're seeing now about, you know, Macmillan publishers struggling with Amazon about how to price ebooks, and the record companies pushing back against Apple about what prices to set, and, you know, supporting Amazon's music distribution, even though Amazon wanted to do a cheaper and freer model. They were worried about Apple's power, right? Apple was setting the terms for how you bought music in a very powerful way, and Amazon is setting the terms for how you buy ebooks in a very powerful way, both in their prices and their business model, but also in the technology itself.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. It gets me the kind of concerns that people have had now for I don't know how many years about the fact that almost all of the media that we consume is controlled by a very small number of very big companies. And there's been huge consolidation over the last, I don't know, couple of decades in all variety of print publishing, in music, television, in video, and increasingly in online provision of online content. And I think that there were a lot of people who really were very excited about the idea of the internet because that was supposed to be democratizing and open things up and was supposed to maybe address those concerns about consolidation. And darn it, if we aren't still in the same place where we've still got maybe we've got some new players in the game,
right.
Big, powerful players, and that we're still got a relatively small number of people who are making decisions about what we can and can't see. And now that we're moving towards a point where probably increasingly in the future, more and more people are going to get more and more of their media mm-hmm. that way by streaming it or downloading it, then the people who are the providers,
right.
they're in a very strong position to determine what you can see and what you can't.
I think that's right. So, you know, I think the hope that you're pointing to about, you know, the kind of concentration we saw through the 70s, 80s, 90s about media production would sort of be undone by the internet. I think we have to let go of that hope a little bit because we mm-hmm. do have to ask, okay, so the concentration of control and ownership has shifted a little bit. And it's not exactly Disney, Viacom, and Time Warner so much as it is Google, Apple, Facebook, Yahoo, Microsoft.
Right.
And so, you know, on the one hand, the questions persist, right? If you have that kind of control, even for the sort of the right reasons, we don't have to sort of imagine twiddling mustaches in this situation. These businesses have to make a business. There's an economic logic to being as sort of large and built out as they are. What are the implications of that? Because they, you know, they're different than people who make widgets, right? They're making the political discourse of our day. They're making the environment in which we have culture. And so they have to be held to different standards than we do the sort of makers of objects. On the other hand, it being the technology companies and the distributors and the platforms may be different than it being the media companies where the consolidation is. It may be that their business model does call for them to be more engaged in providing a wider space. And so we can just sort of call them on that and say, like, you know, where's the edge of that wideness? What's the limit of what you mean by openness? We could see, I think, a site like YouTube or like Facebook really reimagine how the governance of content happens, not just in we can allow more things and because we don't have like advertisers that need to like everything, we don't have to be quite so conservative, but we can actually set the rules together with our users. And it's a much scarier idea, but I think there are opportunities for these sites to think about that possibility. And in the sense that their business is built on the shoulders of their users, they could chaperone those users or they could collaborate with those users. And I think those are very different ideas about what kind of information space, what kind of culture, what kind of political participation you produce in doing so.
Yeah. We have about 10 minutes left in this mm-hmm. part of Focus 580. Tarleton Gillespie, our guest from Cornell University, from the Department of Communication. He is on the campus to give a talk about some of these issues this afternoon. We welcome questions 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. A caller here in Urbana, line one. Hello. Is there a caller there on line one? Yep. There we go. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Oh,
yes.
Hi. A great subject as usual because it's so vast and so international and it covers all so many subjects. One of the things I've noticed about the democratization of, you know, talent where you can use the web at like set up a site or something and have your own, maybe it's your own personal thrill to have something like that. But the vast quantity of this information is so overwhelming that when you go back to the consolidation, like back in the 70s and back in the 50s, when you had film studios, you had record companies who made product, and you know they had a standard of quality that they created, it sort of started to dissipate when you had this democratization. Like you could have your band put it on YouTube, and you know the local garage band or whatever, and maybe you luck out and somebody picks you up or you might sell records over the web or something. But there's what I've always wondered about this is the quality mm-hmm. of the product. You know, I mean, I don't really go to YouTube very often, but I've seen a few things. And it seems to me like that the quality model that the earlier, like Sony Records and those kind of people back in the 70s and 80s, was there because they had selection process. They had people that were very intelligent and very smart about the business model, not so much the business model, but about who, like the Rolling Stones are talented, the Beatles, et cetera, that's kind of obvious. But they would pick these bands and nurture them through a couple albums. Mm-hmm. And that sort of disappeared, I think, right? Or has it? Do you know much about that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the music industry is a great example. Mm-hmm. Part of this story, it's easy to tell a story that, you know, everything was moving along fine and suddenly YouTube showed up and everything changed. I think you're pointing to a much longer sort of trajectory that's important. We, mm-hmm. you know, we of course filter. We, of course, have more people who want to create than we could possibly consume as an individual listener, individual reader. So what's the mechanism that's going to help us find things? Well, one model was record labels have dedicated A&R people. They go find talent. They nurture them. They, you know, they find some local scene that has great bands coming out of it. And they develop the next Beatles and the next Rolling Stones. And we saw both the success of that model and its sort of failure when it became – when it made sense to cut the risks of that process and try to internalize the production of music and try to, you know, make safe bets rather than risky bets, and to sort of take to undo the separation between the people who find talent and the people who sort of market. And in some ways, I think, you know, while YouTube and MySpace as a sort of music environment emerged because the technology afforded certain possibilities, I think it emerged because people were struggling for two decades with the kind of thinness of what the music industry was offering, and the kind of thinness of commercial radio, and, you know, all these ways in which that process you were describing was sort of not doing what it used to do. So now we have another model that says, okay, maybe creativity and quality is going to emerge because everybody throws their stuff on the plate and we all find our things, right? Yeah. And that, you know, both, again, raises advantages. There isn't some sort of filter that's not going to recognize certain kinds of things. On the other hand, it raises other disadvantages. How do we sift through all this? How do we, how does quality stand out among repetition or shock or celebrity or the other kinds of things that draw attention? And each of these models, I think we have to be very smart about the aggregate quality, the aggregate range, and quality is a tricky issue, right? Everyone disagrees on what the best thing is, but range of quality, opportunity of quality, diversity of perspectives, diversity of talent, how do we build structures that are going to find that, but find it in a way that takes best advantage of the fact that anybody who may not have been anointed by a particular, you know, identifying organization might still manage to emerge. And again, I don't think these models, I don't think MySpace and YouTube are perfect for this. They are substantively a different way of doing things. And we have to ask the same questions. Who are the editors in this model? What kinds of things get picked? And is it a substantial improvement over the other model, which did have its advantages?
Yeah, I want to just talk about – this is a complex subject, but also you talked about financial models earlier, and that's very important. As a matter of fact, probably the key to the success of this whole – I don't think there is a true model that works. But I want to talk about one other thing that's sort of – every time I hear someone talking about the web, is that could you talk about copyright? And copyright laws do not work on the web. I mean, it's just, you know, you can steal anything. Basically, people do it all the time. So is there going to be where the copyright laws are going to just disappear and everybody's going to sort of like somehow charge 10 cents for their short story or whatever, their record or whatever? Can you speak to that issue? And thank
sure.
you very much.
Bye. Oh, yeah, you're very welcome. I don't suspect they're going to disappear. I think the copyright has been surprisingly resilient over the several centuries it's existed. It's gone through, you know, it's lasted through some radical changes in how we get content. And it's not a bad arrangement for thinking about a balance. I mean, I think the American version of copyright is built around a balance. We want authors to be able to sort of, gain compensation on their work. We think that sort of granting them the right to own things is a way to do that. But we know that that has problems involved. And so we balance it with the fact that the public needs sort of vibrant information and needs sort of encounters. My thinking about this is that while the business model, figuring out the business model is sort of the key story, we are allowed as a sort of public to say that isn't the first priority. We have some pretty savvy entrepreneurs who, whatever restrictions we give them, saying for the public interest, we need a looser kind of copyright. We need different and more fair use. We need sort of non-commercial distribution mechanisms that aren't considered illegal. We can say that and say that's going to help nurture a kind of creativity and a kind of quality that we haven't seen before, and figure your business model out around that. And, you know, that sounds like, anathema to sort of a business approach to this, but that's how most media has developed. We've said what the criteria are. This is the public interest. This is the health of the political conversation. This is creativity. This is innovation. And now go and figure out how to do that as best you can. I think copyright has a place to play in that, and models that don't need copyright, whether it's, you know, using Creative Commons or Wikipedia or blogging, which sort of does have copyright but doesn't really depend on it. I think there's going to be space for those things too.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes again. 333-WILL, toll free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just for maybe a couple of minutes here to come back to net neutrality. I guess I'm wondering where things stand there. The concern is that one of the wonderful things about the web is that the tools to be on the web are relatively affordable and relatively accessible.
Right.
That doesn't mean everybody can do it, but, you know, it's not that hard. But once you're on the web, people have to be able to find you.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly, I guess, people are looking for things by using the big search engines. Right. So then the question is, well, okay, how are they ranking the hits once you put some term in there and then mm-hmm. you give you a bunch of stuff back?
Mm-hmm.
How are they ranking them? What gets included? Maybe not so much the issue of, is the thing that you're looking for not there at all, but is it number 80 of 100,000? You know, how deep do you have to go in there before you find the actual thing that you're
right.
looking for?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we have to be very smart about the fact that not everybody has access to these things, and it's important not to gloss over that. We're in a very privileged position of, you know, having the technologies and the skills to do it in an academic environment and in a wealthy country. So that's an important part of this puzzle. But as we build both the systems and the kind of rules around them, we can build these for in a smart way that considers those things. So net neutrality, you know, in some ways cares even at a level beneath the Google search question. It's, you know, who's being passed through on routers and telecom companies fast enough. And Google in some ways has been pushing very strongly for the net neutrality model because they don't want to, you know, they don't want to pay fees to accelerate their content. They'd be paying an immense amount of money to their telecom providers. But also because they have developed a business model that depends on people as quickly and freely getting to the things they think they want. So now the question is, what's served up as a search result to the thing you searched for that feels like the thing you want? And again, you know, there were early questions about search engine bias. I think those questions have been asked well. And I think we're at another point where we say, you know, it's not that there's sort of mustache twiddling in this, but the choices that are made in how to design an algorithm are human choices. They're mm-hmm. choices about what looks like the right results. There's a lot of ways to present what the web has for you. And Google made a business on innovating how that was done, radically different than its predecessors. But if the, you know, if Google is overwhelmingly the way people find their way through the web, which it is, and Google is building a business on all these other services, so if you're using Gmail, if you're using Chrome, and if you're using all these other things, you're filtering into that environment, then that question about monopoly or oligopoly is really important. And so their choices about how to serve up information are the same kind of choices that we asked about publishers and broadcasters serving up information that is valuable to the political conversation. You know, the keepers of public spaces deciding what can and can't be said in different environments. But it's done in new terms, and it's done in a way that we don't have a really easy way to ask about because it's buried in the algorithm, because it's buried in a business model that seems like it offers everything. We've got to develop new tools for thinking out those questions.
Yeah. Well, there, we're going to have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. For folks who are in Champaign-Urbana, though, if you'd like to hear more from our guest, Tarleton Gillespie, he'll be giving a talk on the politics of platforms, and I'm sure taking up many of these same issues, this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the campus in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. That's on South Gregory in Urbana. This is part of the Center for Advanced Study Initiative for 2009-2010, Interpreting Technoscience, Explorations in Identity, Culture, and Democracy. And by the way, also if you're interested in the issue of digital copyright, you might look for his book, Wired Shut, Copyright and the Shape of Digital Culture. It is now out in paperback mm-hmm. edition, just came out last fall.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Our guest, Tarleton Gillespie, he's in the Department of Communication at Cornell University.